From KCUR, I'm Steve Kraske, and this is Up to Date. With winter weather stinging the metro area, now is the perfect time to curl up on the couch and read a good book. This hour, our book doctors return with their picks for the best books of 2013. We'll dive into tales about extreme weather, and we don't mean what's outside your house right now. And if that doesn't tickle your fancy, why not try an interactive mystery novel that will make you feel like a private investigator hot on the trail of a conspiracy? These stories and more on Up to Date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. What an idea for a book. One of the most celebrated books of the year is a story of Benjamin Franklin's closest sibling, his sister, who was full of keen political insights and who has been nearly lost to history. Until, that is, the Book of Ages came along that examined the life of Jane Franklin. It's one of the picks of book doctor Jeffrey Ann Gowdy, and it's one of the star's top five books of the past 12 months. More on that book in just a bit, and more on a bunch of other ones, too, as we breeze through the best reads of 2013 with our book doctors, who are arrayed before me, looking all festive in their finest holiday apparel. Our book doctors are Katie Stover. She's Director of Reader Services at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. Katie, always good to have you.
Good morning, Steve.
Good morning. Jeff Ann Gowdy is a freelance writer, editor, and reviewer. Jeff, welcome back.
Always good to have you.
Steve Paul is the newest member of the Star's editorial board. He's also the newspaper's longtime and now former book editor. Stephen, good to have you, too.
Thanks, Steve. Always a pleasure.
How was 2013 for books? Jeff, what did you think? What kind of year was it?
I would say it's a little bit eclectic. I was looking at Marianne Gwynn's recommendations for the best books of the year and the Seattle Times, and when she introduced them, she said that she looked at the Publishers Weekly and the Library Journal's top 10 books of the year, and there was only one overlap.
Yeah.
And it was an obscure debut novel, something about vital phenomena. So I think you could say it's all over the map, or you could say, like Katie said before we started, a year of riches.
Yeah. Well, Katie, these lists are coming out. Is there a consensus out there? Is something emerging as, like, the book of 2013?
No, not that I have seen. Hearing about lots of different books. And I like that. As I was telling Jeff and Steve earlier, that it's a good thing when three of the top newspapers and two of the top magazines publish top 10 lists of books and there's very little overlap. That means, as Steve said earlier, there's still lots of great reading out there. And I like it when there's no overlap, because then it is an embarrassment of literary riches. There's a lot for readers to choose from. It makes my job a little easier, because then I have lots of different things to pull to recommend to different readers, instead of saying, well, this book made the top 10 on all the lists and it doesn't sound like something you would like. But
I was thinking, you know, you could say any year is probably eclectic, Steve, because there's so many books that come out. Mm-hmm. Typically, is there a consensus on the book of the year, or is this your sort of
some years there are and some years there aren't, and I did something similar. You know, I looked a few weeks ago at the top 100 of the Washington Post and the top 100 of the New York Times,
right. And
I looked at our top 100, and there, even over the span of 100, there aren't a great number of overlapping books.
There are not.
Mm-hmm. And part of that is just, it's a whole different mind. You know, we live in the Midwest. We have different, although our list was compiled by people who live from coast to coast, our contributors, but still, everybody has different tastes. And there are very few consensus books out there. I think the Jill Lepore book turns out to be a really major consensus
book. Benjamin Franklin's sister we're talking about.
That's a big book in a lot of places. I think a couple other books we might talk about today are pretty good consensus books. But not necessarily on everybody's top 10 or top 5. They certainly make the top 100 lists, some of our most favorite books. But then there are thousands of other books published, you know, big and small, every year. And, you know, you can look at the bestseller lists and find the, a certain consensus of course, the James Pattersons, the whoever's, the 50 Shades of who knows what. And, you know, there's consensus there. But those aren't the type of books that make, you know, best of the year because they're not the best books of the year. They're just the most popular books.
Well, we look back at 2013. I mean, is there some something we'll recall 2013 for? I mean, some years in recent years we've talked about the year of the e-book and all this sort of stuff. I mean, are independent bookstores holding up? Are we seeing any big trends there? Anything that's really sort of shaking the book world as we enter 2014 here?
Not that I'm seeing.
Yeah.
I get a sense. I mean, certainly the rise of the ebook continues. There may be a certain plateau, but still people are reading on all formats. Amazon did something recently that, you know, who trusts Amazon? I'm sorry. But they they're trying to offer independent bookstores a way to sell Kindles and ebook titles that they'd. And independent bookstores are looking at them like, are you serious? You, Amazon, who killed the independent book business, are now trying to help us out? No, thank you. Yeah. So, you know, so there's still a lot of dynamics in the business and a lot of upheaval in the business. But the great thing, as we've just been talking about, there are lots of great books to read. Mm-hmm. And whatever your tastes, there's something out there.
One thing that I noticed that NPR did that I really liked was they had a list of 200 books, and they invited listeners to put together their own list of favorites. So I think there is a lot out there.
And people responded to that and
that
strung
I can't
them together.
You.
Yeah.
You know, you have a phone here, don't you? Don't you have a call-in aspect of this show?
Well, and by the way, for listeners, with that kind of opening, thank you, Dr. Paul. We appreciate that. What was your favorite book of 2013? What's on your Kindle or other e-reader right now? What books are you gifting this holiday season? 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888, or you can email us at updatedate@kcur.org or tweet us at @KCURUpToDate. Okay, let's move on to some great books from 2013. Jeff Angotti, let's move into Jill Lepore's Book of Ages, this biography of Ben Franklin's youngest sister that so many folks are talking about here.
Yeah, absolutely. Jill Lepore.
What an unusual idea for a book.
Wonderful idea. She actually came to KU to speak, and she spoke at Lead Center on History of Privacy, and I didn't go to that, but I did go to the Hall Center the next morning where she was talking about her new biography of Ben Franklin's youngest sister.
Yeah.
You know, Ben Franklin and Jane Franklin were they were among 17 siblings, and they were called Benny and Jenny. And Ben Franklin, as we all know, grew up to be a famous statesman, politician, author, wrote the first autobiography. And his sister Jane grew up to be mother, grandmother, great-grandmother, and somebody who spelled like a third grader. Huh. And something that I didn't know was that women were routinely taught to read in 18th century America. I wasn't even aware of that. Particularly in Massachusetts, I think there was even a law that female children had to be taught to read. But they were not taught to write. But Ben Franklin gave his little sister writing and spelling lessons. But he ran away from home at 17. So her writing lessons stopped when she was 11. She got married at 15. To the next-door neighbor. And Jill Lepore speculates that she may have been pregnant. And in the conversation at KU, she speculates that she might have even been raped. But in any case, her husband, Edward Meacham, was a ne'er-do-well, and he very possibly was mentally ill. So she took care of him. She took care of their 12 children, only one of whom survived very long.
12 children, even though he had all kinds of issues.
Yeah. And very economic hard time. She took in boarders. She tried a sewing business. And she just held things together. But they had an ardent correspondence. But when Jill Lepore took this project on, what she discovered was a really lopsided correspondence. Because Ben Franklin's letters, of course, are bound in multiple volumes and institutions. And Jane Franklin's letters, the first 30 years, are lost.
Oh.
But Ben Franklin wrote to her more than he wrote to anybody else. And yet, when he wrote the first autobiography, he doesn't mention her once. Which is kind of interesting. He's sort of making the self-made man argument, and there's no little sister in the background.
No one helped me out here. Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, right. But in any case, when she wrote to her brother, she asked for news. She asked for gossip. She lived with a lot of zest despite all the hardship that she endured.
Wow.
She especially wanted reading material. She wanted books, and she wanted books by him. And I didn't realize it, but Ben Franklin, I mean, probably everybody else knows this, started, you know, the first free library in Philadelphia.
Hmm.
And so he started the circulation of books. So it uncovers a really important story that was almost lost. It also rounds out our understanding of Ben Franklin and what he was like. So I couldn't recommend it highly enough.
I was going to say, what kind of read is it?
Jill Lepore is an elegant writer, an absolutely elegant writer. You know, she has an endowed chair at Harvard. She has a regular writing gig at The New Yorker. And so people asked her, like, how do you do this? You know, teach full time, write for The New Yorker. And she said she is always writing. And she also says she drinks a lot of coffee.
Huh. Well, when I first heard about this book, my first reaction was, you know, Ben Franklin's sister, who cares? You know, but clearly that argument isn't carrying the day here.
Well, Jill Lepore says that, you know, if Ben Franklin was every man, Jane Franklin is everyone else. I mean, it's a different sort of historical approach. It's the story of everybody else. It's the story of the common people. It's the story of females at that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What Jill Lepore said was she always thought it would be – she's personally interested in the history of inequality. So she always thought, what if you had a brother and a sister, twins, same DNA, different opportunities, what would happen? She said essentially that's what this is.
Hmm.
That's what the story is.
Anyone else read it, had a chance to take a look at it here?
Have not.
Yeah,
I
Katie?
Have not. She came to the library and gave a marvelous talk on that book.
Everybody I've heard talk about it or who went to the library really impressed, and we were glad to have it on our top five.
I was going to say, we had an opportunity to bring her here, and we didn't do it, and I'm thinking, well, we probably should have done it. That was just a mistake. Okay, we're talking about the best books of 2013. Again, our number, 816-235-2888. Let's go to some phone calls here, and Diego from Overland Park, good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to pitch The Art of Mastering the Art of Soviet Cooking. It's a great combination memoir and cookbook, but it starts out from this really interesting premise where the author who defected to the United States with her mother goes back through the history of the rise and fall of Soviet communism and cooks different dishes she finds emblematic of each of the periods.
Cool.
That sounds like a neat idea. Yeah. Mastering the Art of Soviet Cooking. I had not heard of that.
I've eaten Soviet cooking, and I have a family heritage of Russian cooking, so I'll look forward to seeing that book.
Diego, thank you. I'm glad you called.
Great. Thank you very much.
Philip from Kansas City, Missouri, what was your favorite book of 2013?
Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. It's a great history book, and from I believe he's a professor of comparative religions, and it essentially takes a very historic view of the period of both Jesus of Nazareth and the period around him, what was going on. It's a really, really great book for anybody who's interested in that time of history or that individual.
Well, the author is Reza Aslan, right?
Yeah,
who's been in our studios a couple times, I think, Phil.
Was that the book that caused some controversy? I'm trying to remember.
Fox News, the Fox News religious interviewer probably put him on the bestseller list because she kept attacking him because she was concerned that how could anyone who wasn't a Christian write a book about Jesus?
Mm-hmm. That was it, yeah.
Phil, great recommendation. I'm glad you called.
Thanks.
Yeah. If our listeners want to join our conversation with their favorite read of 2013, what book are you gifting this holiday season? 816-235-2888 or our email address update@kcur.org. Katie Stover, I ran into you at the screening of All the President's Men on Sunday, and you were carrying this next book, S by J.J. Abrams, just the initial S, not just a book, but a reading experience, you say. And you showed it to me, and it looks like it's all of that.
It is. This is a book for lovers of books. It's almost three books in one. It's the book, Ship of Theseus, which is tucked into The Box S by J.J. Abrams and Doug Dorst. And it's the story of a man who's washed up out of the ocean. He has no idea who he is, where he is. And that's the story in Ship of Theseus. When you open up the book, then you get an introduction from the translator of this book, who starts talking about how no one really knows who the author of Ship of Theseus is, V.M. Straka. No one's seen him. No one even knows if V.M. Straka is male or female. Hmm. No one knows the background. And then within the book is all this wonderful marginalia from two lit students, one grad student, one senior graduating, and they have this ongoing conversation with each other within the pages of this book. And then to top it all off, to make the story even richer, there's all these pieces of ephemera tucked in the book which also propel the story. So there's airmail letters, there's photographs, there's postcards, There's a napkin with a map on it, there's a little compass at the back, and as you read this book, you read the story, and then you read the marginalia, and you're getting the story of the two students, Eric and Jen, who you begin to see a relationship develop between the two of them, but they are also pursuing the mystery of who is V.M. Straka, and they're talking with each other within the pages, within the marginalia, but they're also tucking in little bits of evidence, little things that they find. And there's some other fun stuff in here. There's a newspaper article, and you find out that Eric actually set fire to his dorm because he was kind of annoyed. and he was within his rights. There's obituary notices in here, and it's all this wonderful ephemera. And I was talking with Robin Sloan yesterday. He wrote Mr. Penumbra's 24-Hour Bookstore. We were talking about how this is a book that we don't know that it would work very well in electronic format. It could, but this book is relying too much on the tactile nature of reading, the way a book feels, the way it looks, the way it smells, what you touch when you turn the page, and discovering the bits of ephemera and pulling them out. Now, I can see it working electronically on an iPad, the little piece will jump out and you'll look at it and then you'll be able to read along. But you lose, I think, the sense of discovery when you turn a page and something falls out. A four-leaf clover, a note, a photograph.
How do you avoid losing all that stuff?
Well, I have a rubber band around my book.
Yes, you do.
And even the outside of the book has that old-timey book feel. It's the pages are weathered, they're yellowed, there's a little bit of coffee stain here and there.
Wow.
There's an old there's an old library label with the Dewey Decimal System, and I can tell you it is accurately cataloged 813.54. That's fiction. And then in the very back is a return on or before date stamp.
It's an absolutely beautiful book.
It is. It's a work of art, and that's why I called it a reading experience. While I do think it could work electronically, Robin and I both agreed it won't work in audio.
Yeah.
Robin pointed out that this is this time and place, the time of the e-reader, is really the best time to create a book about the reading experience so that people remember what it is you like about the book as an object, and they're reminded that a book can be a work of art. It's not just covers that house a story.
That reminds me of the fact that I'm hearing that Nick Bantock, who has a new book coming out next month, I think, his first one in the last 10 years, and he was a guy who created these books as objects with artwork and with ephemera.
Right. Yes, yeah. I own all of those. Yeah. And those are Nick Bantock, one of my favorite authors of all time. And what's different between Nick Bantock and this book, Ship of Theseus, is that the story is completely told through the letters. Mm-hmm. You have to pull out the letters. You have to look at the postcards. But the postcards are embedded in the page. They're not You don't get to touch the postcards of the Nick Bantock book.
Right.
You get to pull the letters out of the envelope, which is glued to the page. This book takes that premise a little bit further. It makes all the objects, all the ephemera, separate pieces. So if you're not careful, you could lose it. But in a Nick Bantock book, they're all attached.
Well, go ahead, Jeff.
It looks like it'd be a wonderful gift book for Christmas.
I'm
wondering about the cost. I mean, when you think about,
what is the
pricey
cost?
This book is $35.
So a little more.
It's a little more than a regular hardback book. It comes in a box. So, I mean, I'm walking around with mine with a rubber band around it so that I'm not because the box weighs more than a rubber band.
Rubber band not included.
Rubber band is not included.
Although $35 books are not that unusual.
And you know
days.
Who else I would give this book to? I would give this book to a techie friend. Yeah, I would give it to you because you're a bookie book lover. I would give it to one of my reader friends who are techies who like to take things apart. This is the kind of book that would appeal to someone who wants to see how all the pieces fit together. So I would give this to one of my IT geeky friends. They would love to see how all these pieces come together and make this marvelous whole.
Is there a lot of buzz about this book?
You know, I'm not seeing as much as I thought I would.
Given
that it's a J.J. Abrams creation, mm-hmm. and he worked with Doug Dorst, and Steve was telling me about Doug Dorst's other books. And it's not flying off the shelves at the library. I've been promoting it on our library's Facebook Reading Refresh page.
And you are right now.
I am right now. And every librarian I talk to about it has read it and loved it. And it is the sort of book that would appeal to librarians, certainly, and bookie book people like we are. But I'm not seeing it climb the bestseller list. I think it's going to turn out to be one of those cult favorites.
Yeah. Again, that book, S, just the letter S by J.J. Abrams. Mm-hmm.
Right? And Doug Dorst.
Okay. Again, we're talking with our book doctors about the best books of 2013. Let's go back to some phone calls here. Hal from Kansas City, Kansas. Hal, good morning.
Hal. Hi, Steve. Your old buddy from Wyandotte County.
Oh, hey, Hal. Yeah, you bet.
You know who I am. You know, I have a hard time pinning it down on one book, and I agreed with the gentleman about Zealot, The Life of Jesus. I also am high on the book Polio and American Experience. But I got to tell you that my number one book was The Bully Pulpit by Doris Kearns.
Who was just here a week or two ago, yeah.
Well, we're going to be here actually Friday night.
She's here Friday night at Unity Temple in the Plaza.
I couldn't make it that night.
It's coming up this week.
Oh, it is this week.
This Friday night, Hal, at Unity Temple, yeah.
Writer. She is absolutely wonderful. But that's my number one book that I would recommend and give to people.
And you liked it why, Hal?
You know, I think it brought into focus for me for the first time when presidential campaigns became somewhat, you know, they used to sit on the porch and, you know, other people did the campaigning for them, and they didn't do a lot of the traveling. But Teddy, he got out there amongst the people and brought forth this the forerunner of the modern political campaign, although I doubt he ever envisioned it would, you know, start 3 or 4 years before the election. But, you know, the common, you know, the touch he had with the people has always fascinated me. I mean, had he been, I don't even know if I could say that he could have won that race from the Bull Moose, but the conviction of the ability to do that.
Right.
Man was a gifted speaker and a visionary, and,
well, Hal, just a great recommendation. I really appreciate getting it. Again, that's The Bully Pulpit by Doris Kearns Goodwin. She's in town Friday night at Unity Temple on the Plaza. You can call Rainy Day Books in Fairway to grab a seat, 913-384-3126. Maya from Kansas City, Missouri, good morning.
Yes, good morning. I came across a book which I'm absolutely in love with. I'm already late with the thing called me this morning. I'm late to return it. And the next trip will be to go down to the plaza and buy it.
I'll fix that for you, Maya.
I don't want to be without it anymore because I've been just it's just one of the best books that I've ever read, and I read a lot of books.
And what's the book?
Jared Diamond, The World Until Yesterday.
Jared Diamond, The World Until Yesterday. A lot of talk about that. He's been here before, too.
Oh, has he?
Yes.
Sorry, I missed it. But it is, I can just, you know, he speaks about humans since the beginning,
mm-hmm.
and the cultures and the languages. He also touches on food and religion. And it's just absolutely so informing, and it really opens your eyes and makes you think about how we live and how people used to live, and what's coming with the future and all that. It's really, really good.
Well, Maya, great recommendation. Again, Jared Diamond was on Central Standard just in the last couple of weeks. If you want to check out that archived interview, kcur.org, to check that out. Great recommendation, Maya. Thank you. Katie from Kansas City, Missouri, good morning.
Good morning. For those of you looking for Christmas presents, I just purchased two copies of Jim Hyman's Voices in Bronze and Stone.
Ah.
It's a tribute to Kansas City World War I monuments and memorials, so perfect for people interested in Kansas City history.
Voices in Bronze and Stone. That sounds great.
Yep.
Thank you, Katie. Appreciate it.
Yep. Thanks.
Well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation here with our book doctors, Katie Stover, Jeff Van Gowdy, and Steve Paul. We'll turn to a whole bunch of other books, including Steve Paul's, his ranking at the top five books of the year, as ranked by the Kansas City Star, and a whole lot more. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed yesterday's conversations with former Secret Service agent Clint Hill, who jumped on the back of JFK's car that day in Dallas, or our chat with singer Kelly Hunt, you can find those conversations and all of our broadcasts. Just go to kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, the ethics professors are back. They'll take a look at a few moral dilemmas. And in the wake of new outbreaks in New Jersey and California, we'll talk with one reporter about how he overcame a disabling bout of bacterial meningitis. That's tomorrow on the program. This hour, we're visiting with our book doctors about the best reads of 2013. Again, our phone number here, 816-235-2888, and our email address, uptodate@kcur.org. Anita wrote us at uptodate@kcur.org and said, "My suggestion, My Promised Land, The Triumph and Tragedy of Israel by Ari Shavit. I got it because I did not really know the history of Israel without loads of biased perspective. Very balanced and great storytelling that makes you want to stay up and read it late at night." That's My Promised Land, The Triumph and Tragedy of Israel. See, Paul, let's come over to you here. You wanted to talk about the top five books of the year as you ranked in the Kansas City Star this last weekend.
Yeah, real quick, we'll just mention what those were. Jeff talked about Jill Lepore, which made the list, and I will say that the top five was, you know, the top of our top 100 list, which was voted on cumulative votes by about two dozen of our reviewers and contributors and readers and friends, and I was really happy with the way the list turned out. So the Jill Lepore book about Ben Franklin was one. Another book we've talked about a lot on this show in the past, Daniel Woodrell's new novel called The Maid's Version, yeah. The Missouri novel. It's a beautiful book and certainly one of my favorites of the year. It's on the top five. Another book of fiction, George Saunders' book of short stories. Really unusual to find a book of short stories at the top of a best books list, but this was really special and a lot of people liked it. I'll just anecdotally, a hallway conversation, a guest on the previous show, Linda Trout, saw me carrying this book in, and she said she just finished reading that book yesterday, 10th of December. Today, of course, is the 10th of December.
Bingo.
Bingo. So all sorts of synchronicity here. But she said the title story at the end of the book is the best piece of fiction she's ever read.
Wow.
Which I think is a pretty good endorsement. It's, wow. Saunders is just one great writer. He has his ear on the ground and his ear kind of in the head of American people. Of all walks of life and just kind of human behavior, characters. He's snarky at times. He's comical at other times, but really sharply etched fiction. But the big book for me, there was another book, I'm sorry, that I hadn't read, a book for young readers, Rainbow Rowell's Eleanor and Park was a big favorite. She was just in town a few weeks ago. But the big book for me, hard to say who the recipient of this gift would be other than, you know, someone who's really interested in American politics, the economy, our way of life, and what's been going on in our nation for the last three or four decades. George Packer, another New Yorker writer, his book called The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. And I think this was kind of a surprising big book of this year. A lot of people liked it. Everybody, you know, I've seen it on other lists here and there. It's one of those books that is so sharply focused on people and what our nation has gone through in the last 3 years, the economic decline, the social upheaval, the political dysfunction, what led us to this point where we are is kind of his guiding thing. And he does it in a very sort of episodic and novelistic way by following a series of characters, a Southern gentleman, son of tobacco farmers, who is a dreamer and an entrepreneur and starts one business after another and finally ends up in biofuels and in the business, you know, gathering grease, restaurant grease, in order to turn it into rendered products and biofuels. And you watch that his kind of life go up and down through the the economic collapse. You see other people, a woman going through hard times as the Rust Belt declines in Youngstown, Ohio, and steel plants start closing. You're introduced in smaller ways to some interesting characters. Colin Powell is profiled. Alice Waters, the restaurateur from California, is profiled.
Why him?
Well, because of his political centrist. He's a major figure of the 1980s, and he was the point person of the failed of our mistaken attempt to go into the Iraq War. Mm-hmm. So certainly there's a lot of history that we touch on in various ways. There's a really wild Silicon Valley investor named Peter Thiel who's got some odd views of the future. Artificial intelligence. All of these things are kind of woven into a fascinating narrative that takes us from the 1970s to today. He even does he borrows, if anyone's familiar with the old John Dos Passos USA trilogy, he borrows a page from that book, or a technique from that book, which is to capture, as you go through year to year, capture some of the headlines to kind of remind as touch points this was happening then, this was happening then, this was happening then. And so it becomes a very, as I said, a novelistic history. It's all wonderfully written and really, when you get down to it, a little depressing because I think our recent dysfunction and our recent declines are pretty upsetting, but he really brings us into how that all happened and where we are now, and you'd like to think there's a little hope at the end, but I'll leave that for readers to determine on their own. George Packer, The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America, which certainly was one of the big books of the year for me.
Great recommendation from Steve Paul. As we visit with our book doctors, we're running through some of the best books of 2013. The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America by George Packer is Steve Paul's recommendation. Jeff Angotti, let's come back to you and maybe talk about Amy Tan a little bit.
Okay,
she's
Amy,
back.
Amy Tan's The Valley of Amazement. I have to say that this book grew on me. And the farther I got from it, the more I liked it. When I first finished it, it weighed in at 600 pages, and I had to write a review of it. I found it very challenging. It's an extremely thickly plotted book. But it's extraordinarily well-researched. It's a mother-daughter story, just like her big blockbuster Joy Luck Club. But in this case, the mother and daughter are involved in the early 20th century Chinese courtesan culture. And so it is the story of a Violet, who learned some things about herself. I think Katie may have read this book as well. In the 34 years of the book's span, she learns that she is not fully American, that she's half Chinese, that her father was a Chinese painter, and that her mother and her life have uncomfortable parallels. Her mother's a savvy businesswoman, owner of a first-class courtesan house in Shanghai. She learns her mother did not choose that life, that it was thrust upon her just as she didn't choose the life of the courtesan. She was kidnapped as a so-called virgin courtesan. Fascinating story. Amy Tan has joked that this book could be called 50 Shades of Tan. but in fact, commercial sex here is depicted as dangerous, dicey, precarious. So I would very much recommend it. The genesis of this book, initially she was writing a different book, and it was set in the rural section, Moon Pond Village, where the book ends. And she came across a picture of her grandmother, who was posed kind of provocatively for the time in 1910 with a high white collar, with another woman with a high white collar. And it crossed her mind that her grandmother might have been a courtesan, as were one in 100 women in Shanghai in that era. So very well-researched book. I think sometimes Amy Tan kind of fell in love with her own research, and some of the sections sagged for me a little bit, especially a section where Moon Gourd, a former courtesan, instructs Violet in how to be a successful courtesan. It's sex doesn't sound like too much fun in that section.
Kate, you're nodding your head when she talked about too much research. Yeah.
Sometimes, and I'll just skip past a lot of the over descriptions. But yes, authors do fall in love with their research. They get wrapped up in their details, and
journalists do too. And, yeah, been there.
But
yeah.
It's a wonderful book.
I know that world. Yeah,
book groups will love it.
That book, Amy Tan's The Valley of Amazement. Again,
and it,
that's
it
her...
did make, as well as the Kansas City Star's list, the New York Times 100 best.
Yeah. Okay, we're looking for our listeners, your recommendations for your favorite book of 2013. What book are you taking on your warm winter vacation? What a warm, wonderful idea that is right now. What's on your Kindle or other e-reader right now? 816-235-2888 is our phone number here, our email address, up to date. At kcur.org. We received this tweet at KCUR up today from our good friend and librarian Dennis Ross. My favorite adult books of 2013 are Vicious by V.E. Schwab and Ocean at the End of the Lane by Neil Gaiman.
That was a great book.
That was.
Yeah, the Gaiman book was a really fine kind of a fantasy novel that stands, one foot in young adult, one foot in adult, and a totally surprising book, for me. But I liked it a lot.
Gothic, dark, great for teens, great for adults.
And Ellen from Kansas City North writes this: this year I'm gifting Vanish by Will S. Hilton and The Aviators by Winston Groom in hardcover format. They are both going to someone who loves both history and aviation. In fact, he does not read fiction. I wish I could read them before I have to wrap them up. My personal fave reads in fiction were Sun by Lois Lowry, and my favorite nonfiction read was The Holy or the Broken by Leonard Cohen, Jeff Buckley, and The Unlikely Ascent of Hallelujah. This is by Alan Light and uses the song to tell some of the history of music through the years. The book comes with codes for your smartphone to hear various versions of the song. This makes it a nice mix of old and new
tech. I read that book. I thought it was very interesting. I like, as a longtime fan of Leonard Cohen, but it was a good really interesting way to look at the music business, yeah.
The Holy or the Broken is the title of that book. Okay.
Oh, I know who to give that to.
Yeah, there you go.
Thanks,
yeah.
Ellen.
Yeah. Katie.
Yes.
Where are we going here?
Oh, well, do we want to go really super creepy dark, or do we want a mystery?
Let's go dark.
Okay. Well, then, The Dinner by Herman Koch. This is a book that's been... causing a little controversy, we did ask for that earlier, among some readers, because all the characters are really rather morally reprehensible. I think Steve called them misanthropic earlier today. It takes place over the course of one evening, one long dinner at an upscale gourmet restaurant, and think super upscale. We don't ever learn what the bill is. We just know that apparently it's the equal of a couple of mortgage payments. But these
and the ethos is fine dining is creative fine dining. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
The two couples that come together, one is middle class, solidly middle class. The other is upper class, and the gentleman in that couple has very grand political aspirations. He's on the brink of becoming the next prime minister of his country. And the two couples have come together to talk about the reprehensible act that their sons have committed together. Now, as the story unfolds, and this is – I will let folks know this is an exercise in reading. You really need to stick with it to fully comprehend the the natures of these characters, the two sets of parents, and the natures of the sons and what they have done. It comes about one third of the way through the book, the reader will discover what the boys have done, and then it's how the parents are going to deal with the crime their children have committed.
Wow.
And as the parents talk around this issue and past slights in all of their lives come up, you learn so much more about their marriage, their marriages, which is some of it's solid, some of it's on tenuous ground. And by the end of the novel, you're going to be in a position where you're not really certain if you like any of these people at all, but you will understand why they all behave the way they do, why they make the choices that they make. And it's going to be a wonderful book for book groups. They're going to need a little prepping if you pick this up for a book group. And I would give this to the reader on my list who likes a very challenging story. It seems like it's leisurely paced, but it really does move along at a good clip. And you will take turns as a reader hating each one of these characters.
Wow.
And you'll have sympathy for a different character, and then you'll learn something about one of the wives and think, oh, she's horrible. She's shallow. How did these men marry these women? And then you'll learn a little bit more about the politician or the lesser known brother and think, my God, why don't these women leave these men? They have the morals of skunks.
Well, here's a question. Who picked up the tab? I hope it was the richer couple.
I can spill that detail. The richer couple, the politician picks up the tab, but he leaves the check behind for his younger brother to see how much was spent on dinner.
Oh, okay.
And then there's a little plot twist involving the tip.
Okay. That's The Dinner by Herman Koch.
Yes.
Okay.
Does this occur over one evening?
One evening.
Okay.
One evening. And then the couples leave the restaurant. They go to two different places. And boy, do things explode at that point.
816-235-2888 for your recommendations for the best books of 2013. Let's go to Carol from Kansas City, Missouri. Carol, you're on the show. Good morning.
Yes. I enjoyed two big books this year.
Ah.
One was Life After Life by Kate Atkinson. Favorite author anyway, and I thought this was a culmination of all her works. And the other was The Goldfinch.
Oh, yes. Mm.
By Donna Tartt.
By Donna Tartt, yes.
Yeah. Tell us about Life After Life, just in a couple sentences, Carol. Tell us about Life After Life.
Well, Life After Life is a story told over and over again. It's kind of the what if of someone's life. She keeps dying and being reborn, and if a single thing was changed in your life, what would happen? If one thing hadn't happened, how would things have been different?
All right.
It's really brilliant.
Well, sounds great. That's Life After Life by Kate Atkinson and The Goldfinch by Donna Tartt. Carol, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Okay.
Okay. Bye. Bye-bye. Steve Paul, where are you going?
I'm going a totally different direction. This is a year a lot of people look at art books as gifts and that kind of thing, and I'm going to disclose that a good friend of mine is a publisher of a small press in San Francisco and does books that are related to California. This particular book I happened across at the bookshop at the Nelson Atkins Museum one day. I mean, I knew he had published it, but I was happy to find it at the Nelson. It's a collection of works on paper, abstractions on paper by the California artist Richard Diebenkorn, who happens to be one of my favorites. And, you know, it's hard to talk about visual art on the radio.
Tell me about it.
But he was best known for a series from the 60s through 80s called Ocean Park. A lot of people know those paintings of kind of abstract, architectural, kind of geometric pastel paintings of various, almost recognizable pieces of houses and landscape and that kind of thing. But what this book does is brings together some older work and some later work that's very unknown and pulls his whole entire kind of career together in a very small but beautiful package. It's one of those art books. It's not a big coffee table book, you know, that costs $100. It's a very, it's a small paperback. A lot of these works are small works on paper, you know, 15 inches or whatever. But this book is a kind of a small format paperback, but it's just so visually stimulating for all the plates that are in it that, you know, if you love art, if you love drawing and watercolor and Deben Corin might be a discovery for you. He might not, but I just every time I look at this book, I'm impressed by it and just feel like it, you know, it didn't make our top 100 books, but it is certainly should have, and it's one of my, you know, certainly one of my favorite books of the year, just because you know, I just absorbed into the artwork and the paintings. So,
and the title again is,
it's a Richard Deben Corin Abstractions on Paper. The publisher is Kelly's Cove Press from San Francisco, and it, you know, if you can't find it in a retail outlet, you can certainly go online and find it.
That's the voice of our book doctor, Steve Paul. We're also visiting with Katie Stover and Jeff Angotti. We're running through the best books of 2013, and we're looking for your recommendations. 816-235-2888 is our number here. Our email address, update@kcur.org. Let's go to Kevin from Fairway. Kevin, you're on the show. Good morning. Okay, we'll get Kevin just a moment here. Let's go back to, Jeff, you have one from Marissa Silver.
Yeah, this is a book that has really stayed with me over the years. Marissa Silver is a California writer, and this is an elegant book. It's a historical novel, Mary Coyne. It takes what is the most famous photograph from the Depression, Dorothea Lange's Migrant Mother.
No, I remember it well.
And inspires the story.
That's the cover photograph, by the way.
Yeah. And it's altered a little bit, and just as the story itself is altered. Dorothea Lange is here, Vera Dare, and at the time the picture was taken, for a long time the subject wasn't known, but it was Florence Owens Thompson, and she is Mary Coyne, the character Mary Coyne. So there's the two historical characters, and then there's a contemporary character who's a history professor who leads his class through studying photographs to look for clues to the larger story, and how things come together at the end in a very surprising way. These stories alternate, and then at the end they intersect and interlock. And it's also about how the facts about your family are sometimes in plain sight right in front of you, and you don't understand them. But Walker Dodge does when he opens up family ledgers and a photograph falls out. So it's an elegantly written book.
I've heard about this book, Marissa Silver's Mary Coyne.
Yeah.
Okay.
Very much recommend it.
Great recommendation here. Let's go to try Kevin now from Fairway. Kevin, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hey, Steve. Presence Club. I know you interviewed the author.
Oh, yeah.
It's probably the fastest 600-page book I've ever read.
And why was that?
It was just so intriguing. You know, the fact that Bill Clinton looked towards Richard Nixon for foreign policy advice, and Truman hired Hoover to go feed everyone in Europe after World War II.
Yeah.
It was just, what I grasped from the book is, no one wants anyone to fail in that seat, no matter what party they're from.
Yeah. And this is a book that really looks at the ex-presidents and sort of how they get along and move together here.
Yep.
Yeah, great recommendation, Kevin. That's The President's Club, Inside the World's Most Exclusive Club by Nancy Gibbs and Michael Duffy, both with great ties to Time magazine. Kevin, thanks. I sure appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Okay. Katie, you had some leftovers there.
I do. I have Visitation Street by Ivy Pechoda, and I really want to talk about this one. I read this book in March, and it's stuck with me all through the year. This book reminds me a great deal of Dennis Lehane's Mystic River, which is kind of about a murder, and Visitation Street is kind of about the death of a teenager, but it's more about how incidents like this affect a neighborhood and all of the residents, even when it seems the residents don't all are not living as a community. Visitation Street takes place in Red Hook, Brooklyn. You might remember Red Hook as that part of Brooklyn that was most severely damaged by Hurricane Sandy a year ago. And this book takes place right before the hurricane hits. And two girls on a sultry summer night are bored, two 15-year-olds, and they take a raft out into the river, and they decide they're going to paddle their way from Brooklyn to the bright lights, big city of Manhattan, right across. And, of course, it's far too much water. The currents are too strong. And what we learn is only one of the girls comes back to shore in Red Hook, and the other girl disappears. No one knows what happened to the missing girl, and the one gal won't tell anybody what happened that night, because she's not absolutely certain what happened that night. So we have other members of the community, the bodega owner from Lebanon, who's trying to build a community by creating a new community newspaper, gathering information and sharing what he knows about the two girls. And we have a young African-American teenager who longs to leave Red Hook, who knew both girls and tried to follow them that night. And now he's afraid that the police will accuse him of hurting the missing girl and stashing her body somewhere. And then a mysterious teenager who's kind of looking out for the scared African-American boy. And how all these characters fit together. And Dennis Lehane termed this book an urban opera, and he's right. It's got all these wonderful characters interacting with each other. They're trying to build a community around this horrific event. And it's how a crime ripples through a community and how it touches everyone and how they come together and in some cases fall apart.
Did this book make some of the best of lists that came out this
year? No, I don't think so. It's a second novel from Ivy Pechoda, but it's beautifully written. It's suspenseful. It's got very layered characters, and the story unfolds in a simple and leisurely way. You find yourself completely wrapped up in this community. You feel and smell what Red Hook, Brooklyn is like.
That's Visitation Street by Ivy Pechoda.
It did make the top 100 of the Kansas City
Well,
Star.
Thank you for that clarification.
That's because I
had to double check.
It was also reviewed very favorably at the time.
Yeah. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, one quick one. Today happens to be the birthday of Emily Dickinson.
The great American.
Some
new stuff out, some new.
Well, I want to give a shout out to another friend, I'm sorry, but Hadara Bar Nadav, who is a poet and a faculty member here at UMKC, had a book this year called Lullaby with Exit Sign. And it's homage, I'm not sure that's the correct word, but it's certainly a tribute and inspired by Emily Dickinson. Many of the poems are kind of draw from the language of Dickinson. And Hadar is a great abstract, dreamy poet. I mean, she creates these sort of worlds that draws you into surprising places. And certainly we haven't talked about poetry, but that's a place you might want to start.
Pat from Overland Park wanted to recommend Hitler's Furies, German Woman in the Nazi Killing Fields. So that's from Pat. I'm sorry we couldn't get to that phone call. I want to thank our book doctors, Katie Stover, Steve Paul, and Jeff Van Gowdy. Tomorrow on the show, the ethics professors take a look at a few moral dilemmas. And in the wake of new outbreaks in New Jersey and California, we'll talk with one reporter about how he overcame a disabling bout of bacterial meningitis. Our show is produced by Steven Steichman, Danny Alexander, Beth Lipoff, and Cody Newell. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.